Hey folks, welcome to Long Shots on this weirdly smoggy day in Delhi. I mean, sorry Sharad, I just see it out of the window, so yeah. I have to, even though our guest has no idea what I'm talking about, but it's something so evident, so and I thought, let me kick that off.
Yeah, and it's a safe thing to say in the winter months, right?
Absolutely, and so we have with us Mr. Madhusudhanan R. The R is still a mystery. So, anyways, I think we'll call him Madhu for the sake of the conversation. We have already taken preliminary high level, I would say verification from our guest. He's the founder of Yap, which is an API platform for fintech companies. We have interacted with him earlier. You know, we had an email interview with him, but it's really good to see him in person. Hi, Madhu. How's it going?
Great to be here and looking forward to this conversation with you guys.
No, absolutely. The pleasure is all ours. And so, Madhu, you have had a fairly kind of extended career. You kind of formerly at Citibank. Then from there, you moved to Visa. You looked at prepaid products there. Then I think last 6-7 years have been more entrepreneurial. You have been at the app. You know, I'll just start with a very kind of obvious question, even though kind of me and Sharad, we'd like to think that we have some understanding of fintech and the kind of platform that Yap is. It would be good to hear from you what is it that Yap does in the grand scheme of things in a very simplistic way for our listeners. Would love to start off with that.
Sure. I think so we have been, as you sort of rightly said, we've been around for a while. It started, the genesis of the company when I was with Visa, which was my last sort of employment. My co-founder and I were colleagues there. We used to, amongst other things, we both were migrants in Bombay. Came for a livelihood from Chennai, and among the many common interests, between Rajinikanth movies and the masala dosas. We tend to sort of also speak about our work sometimes when we take our tapri breaks during the day, and we often realize that the work that we were doing, especially in an organization like Visa, where we were perched in a position where we have to work with banks, we have to work with new program partners. The nature of the business is it's B2B, right? So you have to get new payment flows, new methods to be tried by new companies, so that there's herd mentality that comes in and everybody will start doing the same thing over and over, and thereby Visa, MasterCard of the world make money on every transaction that gets processed through the system. The thing that we realized back in the day, which is like almost 7-8 years ago, was the fact that as companies wanted to work with banks, as companies wanted to adopt some of the financial products, it is mighty hard for them to actually go and handshake with a bank, even getting to the right stakeholder within a bank. What is their motivation? You'll spend probably a year, 2 years just getting to that point, leave alone whether they're interested in the business, they want to do it or not. So there's a lot of inefficiency that was, that had crept in, and it was not by design, or it's not that somebody didn't want to do a business. It's just that the nature of how banks are structured, when you are trying to do something new where the ROIs are not unclear, you don't know whether the product will work or not, which is what a lot of the fintech and the idea and the whole startup sort of vibe is all about, right? So you think about a problem statement or an idea, you put it out to test and you find the market fit, and then you sort of raise money and sort of expand it and build it into a business. So we realized that that was a very acute problem, and from where we sat, we were at a vantage point where we knew that this was not just a problem in India, it was a problem globally, right? Where increasingly brands wanted to get into financial services, right? So you all the way from Apple, if you look at, they all are getting into sort of financial services play, right? And banks are in denial, saying this is our forte and we don't want, and globally also regulators have never been open for whatever right reasons, right? They've never been open to getting, like, giving out licenses easily and things like that. So we realize that there will be a need for somebody to actually sit in the middle and orchestrate the whole thing. Back then it was more about not really worrying about how large can the outcome be, what is it. So we just felt that this is something that is an interesting problem to go and tackle. And, one day we just had the courage to say, let me quit and start, right? That's how it started.
Yeah. No, that's fascinating, right? I mean, identifying an opportunity in the market. You know, Yap is sort of, you've got a very API first or a very tech first way of looking at fintech, right? It's sort of a horizontal, if you will, rather than looking at a more verticalized lending or credit. Or why is that? Is that by design? Is that just the way you think that the market fit is perfect in terms of how wide it can go? And is that also coming from your background or any kind of affiliation with the world of tech? Because that's sort of something that differentiates from so many other fintech players in India, right?
Yeah, I think the value from where we sat, what we realized when we were starting, the opportunity sets that we saw were largely around payments businesses, right? Because back in 2012-13, you had the likes of Paytm. The wallet story was just playing out. A lot of investor money sort of was coming in. We somewhere still felt that in a market like India, the trust is, you know, typically only with the bank, right? So if you go beyond, let's say if you drive 100 kilometers out of Delhi, a lot of people don't even know beyond a Punjab National Bank and a State Bank of India, right? I mean, today it's a lot more accelerated. 10 years back, there was a story, right? So bank in itself, like, and if you take a south-based bank, Lakshmi Vilas Bank, and put it out in some, you know, in a lane in Delhi, I don't know if people will recognize it as a, you know, bank brand, right? So there's this aspect of trust which we don't see on the surface, but people value that a lot, right? A postman carries a lot more trust than a banker in many of the smaller towns and villages, right? Because he's carrying cash and coming out and giving it when there's a money order and things like that. So therefore, when we started, it was around payments. We realized that while there are a lot of buzz around, you know, wallet companies coming and raising a lot of capital and competing with banks and all, we felt that in this market, beyond the initial hoopla, all of these businesses will gravitate towards the bank because that's where that store of trust is, right? So companies and businesses will have to still work with the bank. That is one peg. The other aspect is that regulatorily, RBI has never been, you know, irresponsible, for a lack of a better word, about giving out licenses. Right? They are very, very conservative in their outlook and then very, very picky and choosy about who to give licenses to and all. So therefore, we realize that it is not going to be like a gold rush or a mad rush to everybody getting a license. So there's going to be that supply side constraint because you will have to work with a handful of banks that can do it. So that's the second dimension to it. And then it was not by design, but more as it evolved. Right? We didn't start saying we will do API platform. Correct, because back then there was no API world.
So, I mean, it's interesting because you, I think, pretty early were the fact that when it comes to underwriting or when it comes to raising deposits at the lowest possible cost of funding, that would continue to mainly be a purview of scheduled commercial banks, as well as then over time NBFC. I mean, it would anyways be a purview of highly regulated entities. That was, I guess, the view you had from day one. I mean, obviously, there was a time when in India, you know, a lot of noise was being made about, you know, peer-to-peer platforms or, you know, pure-play fintech platforms getting into the business of lending. But very quickly, as you rightly predicted, the RBI made sure that, no, then you have to, you know, be a licensed entity, then you have to have, I don't know, X crores of capital, otherwise you cannot do it. And that, I think, acted as a, you know, an entry barrier also to a lot of tech players, but you probably saw it as an opportunity that, you know, let's become like a technology layer between the end user and the banking institution. Is that a reasonable way to think about it?
Yeah, between a brand and a bank, right? So a bank brand and a financial institution, more like. So we don't deal with last mile customer. We are more of a B2B sort of player. It could be any brand that is looking to,
Did the global trend towards tech aggregation also play a role in your thinking, in the sense that, for instance, I mean, like Visa acquired Plaid, right? And I mean, Plaid kind of has the similar, I would say, concept, right?
Even Stripe, I guess, right?
So there are, I think the way, so what happens traditionally, infrastructure businesses, the way they've been built is around, you know, what is the commerce enabling functions that infrastructure business is doing? So in markets where e-commerce thrives, right, you will see a wave of, payment gateway companies come in. Like in India, you know, 5-7 years ago when Flipkarts and the likes were raising a lot of capital, you had 5-6 companies on the payment gateway side which came in. You know, a few of them are large business, like a Razorpay got built, like started five, seven years ago. They are like $1 billion company. Citrus Pay. And then there was a consolidation phase where, you know, some of them kind of, you know, merged and things like that, right? Likewise, in the infra play, anything that is commerce enabling or, you know, driving core sort of, you know, value, you know, creation activity, that will find relevance. Plaid, for example, played in a space where there was a lot of arbitrage around data access, right? So there are thousands of companies that are generating data. There was no one way in which anybody could have access to that, right? Any business unit could have access to it. They just created a funnel through which they were able to ping and provide that data access easily, right? So if independently each of these businesses had to integrate with these thousands of other businesses, it was just inefficient way to sort of do it, right? So they saw that as an opportunity. I think in markets like India, where emerging markets, where regulation doesn't allow new players to come in easily, or new products to be, you know, incubated easily, you know, companies like ours will find a lot of value simply because of the fact that, much like how banks have trust, even working with a bank requires a lot of labor in terms of how well they trust you, you know, what is the pedigree of the team that is behind it, how secure is the platform. So there's a lot of time and, you know, resource deployment in building. It's not like some competition can come to us, right? Even with a lot of capital and start tomorrow and say, hey, I will tomorrow sign up State Bank of India, right? It doesn't work that way. So therefore, even for, and that inherently becomes a moat even for us. And when we look at our business, it's not like somebody is going to come tomorrow and say, you know, we like this business, what Madhu is building. Let me also, you know, raise some capital and let's start building that, right? So while as a business, we will always try and see how we can ring fence ourselves, how we can protect and grow our platform. It's very hard for new players to come in because of this fact that it's momentum. You know, you have to be at the, you know, you have to be always be ahead of the curve, whether it's security and all other aspects that banks value dearly.
I mean, like when I was looking at, you know, Plaid's website, they have a very interesting, I mean, I know it's not like for like, but there are kind of some parallels, right? I mean, on the website, they had a very interesting kind of a small video in which it almost looks like it's like a Facebook login to access financial services from an end user's perspective, right? So, I mean, they were kind of, you know, harmonizing access through that funnel. But I mean, that kind of also, you know, makes me think that the assumption for such a back-end infra-oriented business is that there will be, at some point in time, there will be standardization all across. And but India kind of is a very strange animal in that, right? I mean, it kind of for instance, on the at the consumer end, you know, you have public infrastructure provided by the government. You also have private fintech players doing their own thing. So I mean, there's a lot of, you know, different I would say technological stacks or technological, you know, layers which are being created in clusters all throughout. What's your take on that? Is that a good thing? Is that a bad thing?
Yeah, I think there are, you know, there are two parts to it, right? One, from a recency of tech standpoint, right? Like in India, many of the core banking applications are, you know, sub 10, 15 years, right? A lot of the banks that are licensed out, you know, came in like 4 or 5 years back, some of the small finance bank, payment banks and all. So most bank technology, because of the recency of tech, as well as the fact that many of the products that have been rolled out have also been fairly new. They all run on, you know, relatively new tech, right? And I'm saying this in a very relative sense, right? In the US, for example, it's still, though PayPal came into existence 20 years back, it still is a relevant business, right? Because ACH doesn't work, right? It's broken. It takes 3 days for the money to move and things like that. So if you, from a relative sense, the arbitrage around technology is non-existent in India. So if you're building a business where you're saying, I will make this more efficient, you can't move money more efficient than what UPI does today, right? So it's absolutely real time. It's almost free. So some of those elements has played out really well in India, right? So what that means is, from a user-led standpoint, you comparing it to a, you know, business that is in US, we are already at a state of advantage, right? It's because it's already there and delivered and it's at scale. Like UPI for this is like 2 billion transactions last month. But where does this take you to is in domains which are half served by what the public good infrastructure is building, and the other is half is for innovators to come in and innovate on top of it, right? So which is where India, you know, if you actually sort of look at it as a market, is primed for explosive growth as far as fintech is concerned, because it's not porting what has worked in the US, but it's actually building ground up for what will work in this market, right? That's one aspect of it. The second part to that is, you know, this market is extremely price sensitive, right? So if you put like 5 rupees also on top of something, people are going to walk away, right? So even if it's convenient, we have the luxury of time, so we don't we wait in a queue for, you know, 10 minutes to get things done for free than to pay 5 rupees as convenience fee. So there's that market aspect around pricing, which is very, very powerful. You know, the reason why a Jio is so popular is because it offered voice. You know, that was a Trojan horse for them to say that, you know, we will give you everything for free. And then you like it or not, everybody sort of adopted it. Right? So therefore, this market, you'll have to, even your, you know, the economics of doing a business will actually go through a significant change. So therefore, whatever worked in China, what worked in the US, businesses that try, tend to port that into India, it just doesn't fly. I mean, you'll have the initial, you know, hoopla around it, but very hard to, you know, just, you know, juxtapose that business into the Indian context.
But I mean, like for instance, like you guys are looking at the technological layer, right? You guys are looking at basically the API interface between banks and businesses, correct? I mean, and you also have companies like Setu who are kind of doing, you know, something similar. Like, isn't there a, economics is one, commoditization is another. How does the divergence or convergence works here between different competitors?
Yeah. So what happens is that, you know, you like it or not, standardization leads to is that it leads to consolidation, right? So by definition, if you look at UPI, it's democratized to a large extent, but three players control 90% of the business, right? So it just helps more people adopt it more efficiently. The larger the capital and the access you have, you're able to deliver better. But having said which, I think today we are at a point in time where there's room for like maybe 5,000 different fintechs to come in and operate. We're still scratching the surface in terms of what fintechs can deliver. We're still very, very early in the journey, whether it's digital lending, we are still not there. Like the largest of digital lending companies are like not even covering, you know, Malad as a location for, you know, in terms of the number of people, right? So it is a massive country. So therefore, the opportunity set is really, really large, right? And what's interesting is that over the last, because we are like a, you know, there are so many of these companies that come and work with us, we see a lot of new ideas every time, right? So every day we wake up and talk to new founders who are trying to, you know, incubate and take out products into the market. We see ideas even before they are hitting the market, right? Like we are like the, you know, VC firm without writing the checks, right? So so we kind of see these ideas. So it's refreshing to actually see the number of businesses that are now getting built, which are solving for beyond the what's defined in the, you know, in the investor community as the beyond the India A, right? Which is beyond the first 100 million people. How is business going to happen beyond the top 15 cities, you know? And how is language a barrier in a fintech sort of service? How do you, you know, address those sort of pockets? And very, very sachet, nuanced product are getting built, right? I have somebody who's building a fintech for fisheries as a segment, right? Or neobank for fisheries as a segment, because it's very focused on that business. So that is where, you know, it's exciting because it's no longer about what M2P or Yap as a company can do, or, you know, Setu as a company can do. Collectively, if there is ecosystem can get broadened, and, you know, ultimately the way we are all operating, we are all sort of helping the financial institution or the banks to sort of operate more efficiently, right? So the inefficiency level is sort of just being brought down. And in there is a room for a lot of players to actually come in and operate.
Yeah, you know, we had someone else come on the podcast some time back, and, you know, gentleman was talking pretty excitedly about the role of data in sort of getting the lending right, and breaking down your borrower market and actually putting them in spheres where you can actually go granular and decide the credit worthiness of a person. And they obviously was predicating all this on the rise of tech. For a model such as yours, which is, you know, B2B and sort of providing the tech infrastructure, do you have any access to that data? And is there a way that you as a company think about that data as a potential way to either step into adjacent industries or monetize that on a standalone basis? Or is that something like, you know, we're just mere infrastructure providers, what you do with the data, whether you lend, that's sort of not in my, not a fish that I want to fry. Is that how you think about it?
Yeah, I think the, you know, ultimately the data today, you know, is not something that, I mean, we don't own the customer or,
exactly, yeah,
or the data, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
What happens is that the regulated entities actually own those customers. And in some ways, the brands that are associated with the customers own that data. But what is useful is to sort of, how are you able to, you know, have some meaningful use case around the data that is there in the system? Like, for example, sure. If there is a lending institution and we see the same customer across five different digital lenders, right? Is there value in telling the sixth guy that, hey, this guy is already over leveraged, which is a data, by the way, doesn't even show up in bureau for 3 or 6 months.
Yeah.
But that customer is creating a system with this, not for just the new lender, but for across the board. There is value for everybody in that ecosystem, right? So obviously within the framework of how we obviously cannot like take two bank data and sort of mix it up and use it the way we want it, right? So there is regulatory aspect around it, and you know, we're bound by doing some of that. We still are dabbling with what we can do with the data. I don't think we have data products out there. But and we are also waiting for this larger sort of legislation in terms of how, you know, I'm sure, you know, if you're aware, there's an account aggregator framework that is there. So there's a consent architecture that is getting built in. Once that is in place and once the framework around the privacy law is there, then you can build capabilities which are, you know, within the framework of what the law of the land is saying. Right? Today, it's ambiguous, so you don't want to make a false start and, you know, get into something where tomorrow you have to go and unwind this, because a lot of our implementations are, you know, downstream systems dependent. So it's not like I just go change the code and it starts working. We have to have counterparties also sort of, you know, coding for it. So therefore, we're doing a wait and watch game, but there is like significant data that we have on our platform which can be put to good use.
And, you know, there's a lot of noise around, you know, when we talk about fintech, I mean, there's a lot of noise around crypto, rise of cryptocurrencies and sort of, you know, as a new currency. What are your views around that? And how do you think you're positioned if, you know, you see more pickup around that area? Because, I mean, traditionally, we as a market, we are still a largely fiat money kind of a model, right? So how do you see yourself positioned for that?
So the there's a lot of inhibition around crypto from a regulator sort of sense. But in other markets where we operate, we have a business in the Middle East, we have a business in Australia, New Zealand. So those regulators are kind of open to looking at it, exploring. But in India specifically, there is still, is just warming up. There's a, the phases of it getting adopted probably were in cycle two, right? Where denial, now there is, you know, relative sort of acceptance. So we probably are two phases away before, you know, it comes mainstream or some regulation sort of comes into play. But I think it's for real. It's going to be here. It's just that there are like in other like in Singapore government or the central bank is running a, you know, their interbank clearing into a, you know, crypto based platform, right? Which is not available publicly, but between the bank settlement where there's a lot of money flow that's happening, they have it on a ledger, which is they've been running it as a POC. So as more and more of these regulators recognize and, you know, adopt it, and that becomes into financial mainstream, I don't think we'll be left far behind. There is this fear of a parallel sort of ecosystem running on it, which we don't have overarching sort of legislative powers for. That risk mitigant is what is, I would imagine, is inhibiting our regulators to open it up. But it's just a matter of time. I think 3-4 years out, we will probably be like a massive market.
I mean, we've already spoken about regulators indirectly. I wanted to kind of, you know, pick your brain a bit more about it. In terms of account aggregation, is something already in the conversation? And, you know, only with the time we'll get more crystallized clarity on that. But there have been some precedents which we have already seen, right? Like, for instance, in payments itself, I mean, there was a time when, you know, the regulator kind of pushed for prepaid instruments, and then a public infrastructure was, you know, itself kind of pushed through from the government side, which probably cannibalized, you know, a lot of the private players and kind of payments from a unit economics perspective. You know, it made sure that there is public access, but from an economics perspective, payments is not something which fintech companies can look at as a source of revenue. And then, and most of them are now, including big consumer brands, are looking at payments as a customer acquisition funnel, and then that's being used to cross-sell other things, right? That's, I think, directionally where things are headed.
Right.
On the payments, again, now you are looking at, you know, the government itself saying that let's make a rival to NPCI, you know, let private players have their own UPI-like bodies. So a lot of there's a lot of, you know, like sometimes you know that there's centralization and decentralization. Within payments, it has been a mix of both, for the lack of a better word. And there is a lot of criticism which commonly is thrown that, you know, why don't we have regulatory sandboxes where, you know, new young companies actually get some time to transition into a regulatory regime. And the lack of the same regulatory sandbox made sure that crypto got hit very big in India.
Yeah.
2.5 years ago before the courts came out. How are you seeing things pan out within your domain?
What's happening with payments is more, I would say it just got, you know, caught in the crossfire between a political sort of, you know, statement that the government had to make because they just wanted more, you know, SMEs to adopt and some of that. They just thought it was just not the right advice, you know, the government was given, and they just took a call to do it in a certain way, right? The regulator had little or nothing to do because in India, it has largely been market forces led. It's not the regulator doesn't come in and say this is how the business financials should sort of play out. Other than the fact that thanks to what US in 2010-11 did, where Dodd-Frank Act came in, where the debit interchange was, you know, sort of capped, which led to a sort of domino across the world where every regulator started capping debit interchange, and it was for the right reason that that business model was not structured appropriately, right? It was not done in the right manner. But other than that, I don't see that from a financial sort of playbook around payments business will go through a change, because the moment you take something to a utility, you just have to figure out how to make, you know, business outside of it. That's classic economics, you know, perfect competition sort of definition, right? So you get more players into a mix. So you'll have to figure out something else to do. Otherwise, you know, you're going to get eaten out from your core business standpoint. Having said which, if you look at the new licenses that are being given out and all, I think it's thematically, it is, that's how RBI has been looking at it, right? So that you didn't have a strong domestic sort of network, which is what they incubated initially. It's about playing equal or playing fairly, right? So they incubated and then they gave them the pedestal for them to actually, you know, come up to the same levels as the global sort of companies. And now that they are on their own, you know, it's time for the regulator to step back and say, what's the, you know, regulator looking at, right? They're not looking at 2 years, 5 years journey, but larger consumer interest and how they can product. The only way to do that is to bring more competition into the mix, right? So from regulatory lens, I see this as like a very, very welcome change. It was something that they did to NPCI also 10 years ago, right? So they gave them the license to sort of operate, right? So now it's a turn for others to come in and do it. So I don't see that as a challenge. But I think where, you know, we could have a lot more openness to your point around, you know, is that even in P2P lending, for example, right? So there was a lot of control that was put in where started stifling.
Sorry, just to kind of, sorry to, you know, just interrupt on that point. I mean, there's also that factor of like, if you look at public infrastructure like UPI, there's a network effect there, right? I mean, even though this was an incubated project with a particular purpose of enhancing public access, but we are at a stage where when 2 billion transactions are happening, you know, on UPI and the monthly run rate is just skyrocketing, that has become like the de facto standard, right?
True.
So it does become a bit of a challenge now that one is democratizing it. Isn't it sometimes a question of too late, too little, too late?
No, it wasn't, right? So I think there's still a lot more value that... So, I mean, I think... What happens is that our biases get formed because it's about how we are running our life on a day-to-day basis, right? Like people like you and me who have access to a phone, we just feel that this cannot get any better than this, right? So, you know, if you actually go back 10 years ago, you had a card, you know, in the most frequented metro locations, the card was just getting accepted, right? You would probably drive, you know, 50 kilometers out of Delhi, you may not get acceptance, you know, 5-7 years back, but Delhi had acceptance. Well, there's no issue with using the card at all, right? At least for the last 15 years, that has been the case. So, but if you actually go down further, so in use cases like how, you know, India is a big recipient of cross-border money because we just have a lot of Indians living abroad, super inefficient, you know, models that are out there, right? So the you know, the profit pools are 3-4% for blue collar workers who are sending money home. Huge amount of innovation that can be, you know, brought in. You look at, you know, how vertical financing happens in the country where money has to move from a last mile customer to a FMCG manufacturer. These requires new models, new innovations to sort of come in, right? So you might have a large FMCG company wanting to run a payments business because they probably move 3-4% of the country's GDP, right? So it's valuable for them to run that as a business. So if I have to mock it into the incumbent models, it may not be efficient because those motivations are, you know, the financial motivations around the current models are driven by that ecosystem that is serving that, right? So you might have like a wholesale payment, you know, I'm just making this up, right? I'm not alluding to this being a business model. saying though, so there are avenues that could get be brought in which can actually make it a lot more efficient. That's where innovation will thrive, right? Having said which, to your earlier point, it's still not clear on other use cases that are not tested, like giving out a network license, giving out new bank license, all great, it's time tested. There's only counterparty risk with respect to settlement and clearing that RBI should be sort of worried about. But new things like P2P lending, right? China may, it is a big rate, right? I mean, obviously, even the Chinese government cracked down on it because the interest rate were going at 500%, right? At that kind of interest rate, you could borrow for hours, right? So you could borrow in the morning, give pay back by evening and pay like 2-3% for it. If you analyze it, it's like 400-500%. Obviously, at that kind of, you know, income levels, any amount of loss rates you can absorb, right? So, you know, and the whole Ant episode listing, IPO episode is actually sort of because of that, right? Our regulators never wanted such a, you know, buildup in the market because that will just lead to unfair practices and it will just create a negative trend. So they restricted it so much that it was a stillborn child. So P2P lending in India has not sort of taken off because it just was prohibitively, you know, expensive from a governance cost standpoint to run that as a business. So some of it, we have to just not be so tight twisted about it, right? But when a regulator looks at it, maybe they have a different sort of viewpoint. So like crypto again, right, is something that world over it is being tested. You could have like a, you know, control boundary which you could draw and say that this is what we are comfortable sort of testing for the next 2 years, right? You can be 100% regulated by doing zero business, right? So you can, that's not ideal from an innovation standpoint.
You know, given like we're talking about UPI and the existence of a nationwide core infrastructure, right? So the need to build an infrastructure for new players obviously is not there. I mean, you already have a infrastructure that you can piggyback on. With that given, right, like where do you think the next set of innovation will come? And for you as a, you know, running a company in the, you know, tech API space, where do you think, you know, where the next growth levers are for you? Is it just going deeper into the existing customer base and try to get more and more people into the ecosystem? Or do you think like there are, you know, additional growth levers that are still not, you know, very intuitive as of now?
I think what's happening, the secular shift that we are seeing is that a lot of the business use cases that, thanks to UPI as well, right, to a large extent, there is a wave of, you know, embedded financial services that are coming into play, right? If you just, to the earlier point that we were discussing, if payments doesn't have money, the companies that are actually building a business around payments are naturally gravitating towards, can I lend? Can I do bookkeeping? Can I do tax filing, right? So those playbooks are actually evolving, right? So when they do this, it's not just about lending. I will probably offer a chit fund kind of a product where they can save every day 30-40 rupees, right? So to a cart vendor, whatever extra cash he has, can he just log into his app and say that, you know, move this 50 rupees into my khata, right? So a saving tool that could, in, you know, we are already seeing that khata having a, you know, collection for gold as well, right? So every day, whatever is this, the rounding of amount to the nearest 100 goes into a gold sort of kitty for that, you know, push cart vendor. So you are seeing this embedded sort of playbook getting accelerated because payment business have to figure out where they will make money, right? So it's actually nudging them to do that faster, right? So that's one clear theme that we are seeing. The second thing that we are seeing is that on the not so urban focused sort of playbooks, right, where farming or many of the industries that are beyond cities, we see heightened action happening, right, where people want to embed financial services as part of their playbook on day zero, right? So we have a startup that works for interior work where, you know, you can say that I want to break down this wall and change it. So this company actually, you know, not just gets you a mason to fix the job, but they'll do the estimation, they will get you a loan, they will get you, the product providers to sort of come and fund. So all of that is happening today in an accelerated fashion. You know, it may be small today, but I think that's a good start, right? So there could be, we are privy to one company, there could be hundreds of such sort of innovators who are actually sort of building. So that foundational layer is this whole access to UPI, everybody having a bank account, that's the foundational layer, right? So that's, in many ways, we don't, it's not visible to our eyes because it just become a way of life for all of us, right? Like you paying a chai wala for the chai that you had, we would have never imagined that, you know, 6-7 years back, right? 7 rupees or 10 rupees to be paid from your mobile phone for that sense.
Yeah, no, I wanted to, just ask a little bit from a business operation standpoint. You've been successful in raising a bunch of money and from, you know, credible investors at angel level or VC level. How's that journey been, and what is it? How did they discover you? Did you go through a form, you know, properly pitching around, looking for opportunities, or did it come easily to you? And how was that experience? That would be a fascinating thing to hear about as well.
Yeah, I think we started the business. We said, you know, as I said, you know, when we started out, we kind of said, you know, anything that we do, we'll have to make sure that it makes money at a, you know, it has to be built on first principles. So we got lucky. We had a bunch of customers who signed up. We started cranking some revenues. So the first year we spent where, you know, we actually sort of closed the year in green. So we said, if we are able to survive the first year, let's push it some more. So we did that for 4 years, right? 4 years, we never went out to raise capital. But, you know, late last year, we realized that having some growth that we were seeing, as well as the opportunities that were getting presented in front of us, we said it's now time for us to go out and sort of raise money. By the nature of what work that we are doing, we're super connected within the VC community, because a number of startups that are on our platform, those investors talk to us. There is a deal flow. We are like the, you know, index, you know, or the barometer for fintech. So it kind of, they run those ideas through us. So we had it, I would say, you know, it was easy going from our perspective, in the sense that a lot of the folks that we knew who could add value, we could approach them and say that this is what we are doing. Would you guys be interested in sort of investing behind us? And we kind of had, you know, buy-in almost immediately. So it's been a blessing from that perspective as well.
Was there like a, I mean, obviously these things are so much linked to the overall digitization wave.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, I'm pretty sure like 10 years ago when you were probably trying to, or 5 years, I mean, sorry, 6 years ago when you were trying to explain to someone what you do, I mean, and versus you having that conversation a week back.
Even now we have that challenge, yeah.
I mean, yeah, I'm sure.
Even now we have that challenge.
Yeah. So, I mean, and that must also be true in case of talking to VCs, right? In the sense that, yeah. I mean, because, I mean, like, there's no precedent in terms of how fintech is evolving within India. So, was there like an inflection point when you saw that now it has becoming a much more mainstream idea to talk about?
No, actually, in fact, if you look at our angels and how we went out raising that first round of money also, because of the nature of this business, it's very, very nuanced. So for a VC generalist, right, typically folks, I mean, with all due respect to them, they would never be able to get into the level of detail of what we do as a business, because they are not expected to be, right? So therefore, oftentimes what happens is that if you are, you know, if you are comparable in the US or other market where it's a multi-billion dollar business, it's easy to sort of place yourself. Like in the US, this payment business, the take rates are 20 basis points. In the Indian context, it will be 10. So if there the the revenue multiple is 20x, India may, you know, 15, 16, you will sort of get. So you're able to get to a framing, as it's called, right? When you don't have a comparable, they say that, you know, there is no comparable because of a reason. This business doesn't have legs, right? So that's the, you know, hypothesis starting point, right? Unless you have like massive sort of traction and it's a consumer business where, you know, it's specific to the local market, it's very hard for them to get that framing right. So therefore we said, when we started doing our initial sort of groundwork, when we started talking to investors, we realized that explaining this model in itself becomes hard, and then therefore to convince them to see, you know, if somebody is coming in at a certain value, they will see how large this business and the opportunity can get, right? So if you're coming at, let's say, $1 million, can it become $1 billion company? That's where, you know, they are in identifying the false positive, right? So therefore, we said we need to get people who understand our business, which was very important. So the first set of angels whom we got, whether it's Amri, Jitain, Kunal, all of them have been, you know, fintech, you know, entrepreneurs. The moment they sort of said yes, and it's also about signaling, right? So the market also sort of takes notice when such super angels sort of invest, people sort of get it, right? There is some merit in this business, and, you know, and then you are able to actually figure out who are the sets of investors who will probably be in it for the long term to, you know, help us build it.
Yeah, you know, you use the word comparable. So who do you think are your comparables in the world? Are there any companies, even if they're not direct comps, but companies that you look up to, or companies that, you know, you look
up to? So there's this company in the US called Mercator, which is a $10 billion. They are going IPO next year. It's almost valued at $8 to $10 billion. Massive sort of business. You know, US is fairly simple. You know, there's only cards. You just have to solve for cards in one state, one language. No barriers. India is this, and there's a lot of money on the table, right? So there's generally more money on the table in terms of what businesses that you run. So, you know, if you contextualize this to India, there is very little or no money in the business. You know, you have like all kinds of payment methods. It's already super efficient. So the value scraping becomes that much more harder. But they are one comparable, you know, and in the US, there are three or four other companies that are doing this. But, you know, it's a hybrid. So we are not just a straight comparison, but as you said, a flavor of Plaid is there, a flavor of Marketa is there. So it kind of built for, you know, addressing the challenges of this market.
Yeah, no, a Plaid, we remember, I mean, got taken out for 35 times sales. So that was, you know, seemed like a fairly lofty multiple, but obviously it has the growth runway built in it. And I guess you're in that same spot as well. So that's pretty good.
No, I mean, this was kind of a very interesting chat, Madhu, because we obviously went into payments, lending, regulatory frameworks, and we ended up with like a VC playbook on how to raise money by getting expert investors first. So, no, this was incredibly insightful. Thanks a lot for your time. And I think, as you said, I mean, it's a kind of a very exciting time to do what you're doing. Obviously, the challenges are there in terms of fundamentals, in terms of economics, in terms of just the variety of the market. But that's why everyone is so psyched about fintech at large. So I wish you all the best. I think the smogginess outside has now become slightly darker.
Yeah.
So it's also a good time to probably, you know, sign off. And I think we'll be back soon with more similar exciting chats, albeit in similar or different sectors. Huh?
Yeah, it was a fun chat today. And next one should also be a lot of fun. And it was good to have you, Madhu.
We don't know who the next one is.
Yeah.
We don't,
but we are sure it's going to be fun. Great, great. Thanks a lot, Madhu. Thanks a lot. Take care.
Thanks,
have a good
one. Thanks, Nikhil. Thanks, Sharad.
So this is Nikhil Arora, and this is Sharad Tupran signing off.